Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm pleased to be rejoined today by the entertainment strategy guy of his own Substack. And he's over at The Ankler, of course. Everybody loves The Ankler. Thank you for being back on the show today.
Always happy to be here. And as always, it seems like there's a ton of news and shows and films to talk about. So excited to get into it.
There is never a shortage of news. All right, so the first thing I want to talk, the reason I reached out to you is because very specifically I wanted to talk about F1's box office, because it's a real Rorschach test, I think. I think you can look at this, what the movie did this weekend at the box office, and spin it any number of ways. So just to lay it out for folks, the movie had been tracking at between, I think, $35 and $40 million. For its opening weekend domestically. It ended up grossing $57 million, which is obviously very far ahead of that number. But, you know, the other thing you have to keep in mind here is that it is either a $200 million movie or a $300 million movie, depending on who you want to listen to, which basically means, as Matthew Bellany noted over at Puck, this is essentially the same as The Flash, which was a world historic bomb. The big question, I think, for you, Mr. Entertainment Strategy Guy, is does this number prove or disprove your theory that everything that is on streaming should go, or maybe not everything that's on streaming, but movies with a potential for box office success should always go theatrical, not straight to streaming?
Yes. And so that's the podcast. Okay. So first you mentioned, I think F1 is like a brilliant little film this weekend, because it, again, like you mentioned, the Rorschach test, because there's so many different ways you can look at it to judge, like, was it a success or failure? And I think in a lot of cases, except for one example, all those different answers can be right simultaneously. So first, I don't really care about when a film beats tracking. I think it's good, but in a lot of ways, it's sort of like that says more about how the tracking models are going than it says about the upside of the film itself. It's sort of like when a stock pops on its IPO. That's actually not a good sign. It means the stock needed to be priced higher, that you didn't do a good job. You should have priced your stock higher and you would have made even more money. So the one way to look at it is the genre expectations. And so one thing that I think is different between this and The Flash is that The Flash had to live up to superhero movie ceilings. And when a superhero movie does well, you're talking Black Panther, Avengers Endgame. Maybe we'll see in July some certain films. But we're talking films like Deadpool and Wolverine from last summer. We're talking films that are doing well over $100 million in their opening weekend. And so The Flash didn't do that. So that's partly why it's a disappointment. F1, on the other hand, is an original film. And original films, as we've seen for a while, just haven't had that same sort of ceiling at the box office, except for very rare outliers, like the Barbenheimer phenomenon. So in this sense, it's better than that. The problem, as you mentioned, is also the budget expectations. And if you make a film for $200 million, and everyone has to remember that when it comes to box office, half of it goes to the theaters, half goes to the studios. And then overseas, it's actually a little bit lower than that, depending on the territory, say 25 to 40%. So a film has to get at least over that to earn back its production budget. And that doesn't account for marketing, but then it can make money in other windows. So when it comes to budget expectations, if it is really up to a $300 million film, it's $60 million. It's much less likely to make that back. That all said, the main argument I make about straight to streaming films versus theatrical films is that it's twofold. First, the awareness boost a film gets from going into theaters helps it out for the rest of its life, especially if it's considered a success at the time it comes out. And F1 has a very good cinema score, got good critical buzz. People are talking about it as a word of mouth hit. So it's actually going to benefit from that in every other window that it goes to. And then the second piece of it is that you just make more money when someone goes to theaters than you make on streaming. And the way to think about this is you have a monthly subscription. Your monthly subscription pays for everything you watch on a streaming service. Now, if you sign up for Apple TV Plus and only watch this movie, then essentially, yeah, you're paying whatever Apple TV Plus is, isn't it, over $10, right, just to watch that one movie. But if you watch it with your significant other on the couch next to you, that's divided in half. Versus, again, going to theaters where now you're paying, you know, in many cases, $16 to see the movie in primetime on a weekend. So you just make more money than you would have made otherwise when it comes to going to theaters.
Right. And there's also the premium large format factor here, right? I think 25% of F1's gross came from IMAX screens, which, right. You know, you said $16 ticket. I mean, for IMAX, you're looking at $20 a ticket, $21 a ticket, you know, maybe up to $30 a ticket in New York or L.A., I think.
Right.
So obviously there's a big boost there. But the other issue here is if you're going to make the movie anyway, if you're right. going to spend the $200 million, virtually anything you get at theaters, in the theaters, is gravy, you know, though there are advertising costs, et cetera, et cetera. Right. I find it hard to believe that there's any real downside to, if you are making this movie anyway, putting it in theaters.
Correct. The only caveat I put to my analysis, and again, like, I think I'm probably one of the most prominent people that thinks most movies should go to theaters versus not going to theaters out there, having done the analysis over on my newsletter at entertainment.substack.com, is the one caveat to it is, if the films are very small, I'm much more willing to say, you know, give it a streaming only release, like Disney Channel original movies. I've been on a big kick that those are really good investment for Disney because they're much smaller. But yes, when it comes to a movie that costs $200 to $300 million, not putting it in theaters, there's very little downside, but there is one downside, which is what I call the Argyle treatment, which is that if a movie flops in theaters, it gets just a tremendous amount of news coverage, no matter, even if it's a small movie like Karate Kid, right? That's not the world's most expensive movie, but the weekend it came out and missed in theaters, there's wall-to-wall coverage in all the trades. The same weekend, Another Simple Favor came out on Prime Video. It's a very small movie for Prime Video, was not a big hit, got drastically less coverage. You don't have wall-to-wall coverage saying, hey, this was a big miss to it. And I call that the Argyle treatment, based off the another Apple TV Plus movie from last year, which was Argyle, which flopped, I believe, in February and gave them a bunch of bad coverage. So that's about the only downside, is you get bad coverage. And so that's why I think Apple, in this case, pulled out all the stops to really try and make F1 pop on its opening weekend.
I guess this dovetails with a secondary question that you had raised, which is F1 the sport, not the movie, is F1 the sport a genuine butts in seats phenomenon in the United States, or is it just kind of background noise? Is it not the big driver that that fans of what's the F1 show, Need for Speed?
Drive to Survive.
Drive to, thank you.
Which I think
close enough.
It got name dropped in the movie, actually. At one point someone says Drive,
like, kind
to
of
survive.
Dismissively. Kind of, you know, the bad guy in the movie is like, "Oh, you know, I got into it from..." But so is F1 a big deal? Is it big intellectual property, or is it not? Is it just kind of nice to have around?
Well, first I want to give F1 credit in that globally it is a really, really big sport, and it really does drive global viewership numbers that are impressive. The one caveat to that is, and then also they had Liberty Media took over in the mid 2010s. And they've actually done a lot for the growth of the sport, especially when they first joined. The problem is recently they've stopped providing as many global awareness number, viewership numbers, something they used to provide. So it's tough to see how that's trended. The U.S. growth for the last few years has actually been flat in the U.S. And that's actually been a very underreported story. So to answer your question, I think F1, since it moved to ESPN and then did get Drive to Survive on Netflix, has found a new core fan base. But when you look at the actual viewership figures over any given time period, they really pale compared to most major sports in the U.S. And as I pointed out a few weeks ago, like the WNBA, for example, like is beating it in a lot of viewership figures, or is it about the exact same level for small games that don't involve Caitlin Clark and some of the other superstars in the sport? So it has its devoted fans, but it's definitely not huge. As for whether or not that drove F1's viewership, absolutely think it played a part. People who had seen Drive to Survive saw an F1 movie and went to go see it. But it also had Brad Pitt and the director of Top Gun Maverick and a pretty big marketing campaign and looked good and got good word of mouth. And I think all those factors combine into one, and it's tough to ever isolate just one.
Can we, this may be moving beyond your realm of expertise. Feel free to beg off if you don't have any thoughts here. But I was fascinated by the marketing of this movie just because of the way it was kind of integrated into the whole Apple ecosystem. Like, I opened up just one random note here. I opened up my wallet on my iPhone because I was trying to find a ticket to a movie or something. I was trying to find a ticket to a concert or a movie or something. And I open up my wallet, and right at the top of the wallet is an offer from Apple that says, hey, you want to go see F1 in movie theaters? We'll give you $10 in Fandango cash. You can go see it now. Which I find fascinating. I assume this was mentioned other places. I assumed other. But I just happened to stumble on it because I am like deeply entrenched in the Apple ecosystem. Do you think that is kind of a sign of how these big tech companies can leverage what they are doing to bring more audiences in? I honestly would love to know what the number of those redemptions was. I would love to get the inside data on this, because it is a fascinating thing, and it almost feels like cheating. It feels like cheating is what it feels like. If you have, you sold a million tickets this way, like that's, you know, that feels a little bit like cheating.
Yeah, I had that on my list of notes when you mentioned this topic to bring up, because I think it is a big caveat. I wouldn't say it's cheating, but it definitely is. It's gaming the system because, yeah, and if you're doing the accounting right, if you subsidize every ticket by $10, and say, again, the average ticket price in the U.S. is still about $10, at least according to thenumbers.com, you're essentially giving away free tickets. And then when we focus on box office, that's not really the same. Again, we don't know the number of redemptions. There's a lot of caveats. As to your point, I actually think this is a new tool a lot of the streamers could use, not the discounting per se, but using the platforms to really drive viewership of their new movies. I think Disney over the last year or so has gotten better about using Disney Plus to push new movies, especially the ones based off sequels like Moana 2 or Inside Out 2. I think if another platform with a big red logo ever put their movies in theaters and they put the trailer on top, and they had a link out to Fandango, say, go see this Netflix original film in theaters, I think that could really drive a lot of engagement. I think Prime Video is going to try and turn that on. That's ignoring the discount fact, which is if you're discounting, that's just never a sustainable thing. I do think that drives back to how much Apple wanted to avoid negative headlines here. And so, you know, offering a bunch of free tickets for them gives them the ability to not get those negative headlines, but also speaks to headlines we saw earlier this year in the information that Apple's losing $1 billion a year on streaming. Offering discounts for every movie is essentially like kind of a Ponzi scheme, and you're going to keep losing money you know, but just we don't actually have the numbers to know how much that is.
Speaking of streaming and Disney, let us turn our attention
Can I do one?
To...
I pulled the Nielsen data for the top Apple films.
Yeah.
Is there any chance you can guess in total hours what the top Apple film was this year so far?
The top Apple, top
original
Apple
film.
Original film?
Yeah.
Give me a hint. Is it a movie that came out this year?
Yes. This just for this year, and it's actually the biggest first-run Apple film of all time.
I would guess it's probably the... Is it The Gorge?
It is The Gorge. Wow.
Ah, okay. See, I know what I'm doing. I know who's big star is that Anya Taylor-Joy. People love her.
I literally pulled that and could not remember what The Gorge was about and who starred in it. My researcher could. He nailed it with Miles Teller. But I think
Miles
that's...
Teller.
I think that speaks, though, to F1, is that if we polled a bunch of people in 6 months, what is The Gorge? What is F1? You're going to just get way more name recognition with the other one. But Bravo.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. And that speaks to the theatrical business entirely. So,
yeah. No, the Gorge, it's interesting because the only other option really is Fountain of Youth. And yeah. I don't know another other person except for people I've done podcasts with who have seen the Fountain of Youth. So,
and I think Fountain of Youth also falls into that. I would call it like the Another Simple Favor, and that by all rights, it's a miss. But Apple had it avoid theaters because it likely would have been a miss there. But that doesn't make it a hit to make it on the Nielsen top 10 for 2 weeks. It's still a miss. It's just a miss that not as many people know about. So,
yeah, no, that sounds about right. All right. Let us let's shift to streaming Disney and the world of animation, because one of the big stories this week, just in terms of pure box office, is the failure, the crushing failure of Elio, which is the latest from Pixar Disney, grossed, I think, about $20 million in its opening weekend, then dropped 50% or so this weekend, which is a bad number for animation. These are the sorts of movies that have to hold for a long time. You see that occasionally with something like Elemental, which opened relatively soft and then had a multiple of 8 or 9 or 10 or something, some ridiculous number to get up to around $500 million worldwide. Good for it. Elio has bombed badly. There's all sorts of recriminations going around, but this is one of my big theory on this. And tell me if I'm being crazy here, is that it's actually fine if a movie like this loses money in theater. I mean, not fine. It's not. Nobody at Disney wants to lose $200 million or whatever this movie's going to lose, but it is acceptable to lose that sort of money because you have to have the originals. In order to make the things that will end up making money in theaters for Disney, which are the sequels. And we see that with Inside Out 2. We see that with Moana 2. Even the live-action Lion King movie hung around and wound up probably just about breaking even. I believe that, as we were saying with F1 and... The Gorge, that the name recognition that comes with putting something in theaters, the imprimatur of quality that says, here's a theatrical movie, you should watch it now on VOD, is the sort of thing that is needed to create the sort of brand awareness and potential IP to exploit of something like Elio. Is that wrong, or should Disney only be in the sequel business for a while?
If you're only driving for short-term financial gains, Disney will only be in the sequel business. But even Wall Street should know, to your point, that they should not only be in that business because they're here for the longer term. As most people point out, and I like to repeat, you know, making movies or even streaming or TV shows, it's a portfolio business. Which means, like stocks, you know, you're buying 10, 20 stocks. You're hoping that a few go up, but the ones don't go down, they hold even. And then the ones that go up pay for the rest. Or the other analogy would be venture capital investing, right? Hitting one Facebook is the goal. The key is managing your costs for the other things. So that applies to Disney in this case, which is I absolutely think they need to keep making originals, because when the originals hit, it spawns everything from theme parks to toys to sequels to potentially TV series. and that's, or in live action remakes, and that's why you need to make the originals. The key in what I think has really been a problem post 2010s is what the production budgets are going into them and how long some of the films have taken to make. They've actually really gone a lot longer, and some of the production budgets have been really crazy. And a lot of that is because we were basing, Disney was basing some of their decisions on how strong their 2000 to 2010s hit rate was. And they got to a point in the 2010s where even on animation, it seemed like they couldn't miss. Now, they still had misses like The Good Dinosaur, but they weren't as notable because they had this other stream of original hits like Inside Out or Coco coming to theaters. And I think Disney obviously needs to keep building that well. If they can keep the production budget smaller, that's going to make it even better. As for whether, you know, I've seen people propose, hey, they should just go straight to streaming and test it out there. As we just had the whole discussion, you know, when something hits in theaters, it boosts the profile so much more that you just can't ignore that boost. And I think if a film or show does hit in theaters, like, for example, Elemental, which had those long legs, it then ends up having very long legs in streaming. And we just haven't seen Disney's streaming originals have that sort of success.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest, it's funny, somebody asked me on Twitter about Moana, or no, it was Encanto. Yeah. Encanto, and I was like, look, I think Encanto was not a big success at the box office, but is ultimately a pretty big hit for Disney, because it's literally the most viewed movie of all time, right? Like, that's where that movie breaks down on streaming, and I not just for Disney, right? Like, I think that is the most streamed.
Of all movies, again, this is according to the Nielsen top 10 charts and how many weeks they've lasted on there. Although I believe I could also look at their annual charts. But yes, it's the most viewed movie, period.
Which is wild. Which is, I don't think nobody would have predicted that. That's not, see, this, and this is what, this gets to my point, which is that you never know what is going to hit. And eventually there will be an Encanto 2, and it will gross, I don't know, it'll gross $400 million domestic and everyone will be very happy. But you don't get that without taking the shot on it in the first place, I don't think.
Exactly. I think the one other caveat and idea that has changed is fewer people are going to movie theaters and they're not going as often as they did in the 2010s. And I still think that's one of the big hurdles facing all the original films, because if you're going fewer times per year, I like to put myself in the customer's shoes. And I think what happens a lot of times is if it's a family, they look at the theatrical slate. And if they're only going two times per year, they say, well, what films are we going to go see? And they're like, okay, well, this year it's Minecraft and it's Lilo and Stitch, right? And so expanding that theatrical pie, which I still think could be possible, is, I think, something that the studios and theaters need to work together on. But again, one of the problems, I think, with Disney through the 2010s is there's a lot of rumblings that they started to play very aggressively with theaters, demanding more money to come back to them because they were so powerful and they had such sway. And I think Disney playing nicer with theaters should know that to build those hits, they need to have those positive relationships. So that's something I'm still keeping an eye on. And I think as an industry, we still need to look at.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And it dovetails with everything else that's going on with Disney too now, right? Like, you can't, if you put out a series of Marvel movies like I don't know, like Captain America, Brave New World, and Thunderbolts, and right. I don't know, even Shang-Chi and the Marvels, right? Like you can't then strong arm theaters into giving you a 75% of the, you know, first two weekends gross. You can't right. you can't force them to commit 4 weeks of their best screens to your theaters. Right. Et cetera. Like there has to be some give and take there.
And we're down 5,700 screens. I think I'm going to be publishing later today, compared to the peak. We probably did have too many screens at one point, and moving to smaller seats, higher quality screens across America, I still think will be a good thing. But overall, I think for the theatrical entertainment business, looking at the number of people and how many times they go would be a key metric. It, you know, in some cases, I'm semi-proposing lowering prices, because if you lower prices, more people go. But I think rebuilding that habit is crucial. Not sure I've seen a lot of movement in that direction. The other piece I think would help would be more competition in theaters, and that would mean breaking up the big theater chains. I'm not optimistic any of that happens for at least 3 years, though. So,
yeah, yeah. All right, let us continue in the world of streaming here, because you have a piece out this week suggesting that the streaming wars are finally getting competitive. And I'll say, as somebody who had, you know, kind of gotten tired of looking at the top 10 charts and seeing, you know, 8 Netflix movies and 8 Netflix shows and 1 HBO show, maybe 1 Paramount show, or, you know, 7 Netflix movies, 1 Paramount, and 2 Disney Plus originals. I have to say I'm pretty happy to see the wealth get spread around a little more.
Yeah, and specifically in the past, especially when the streaming wars launched, I used the analogy that before we had good ratings data circa 2019, if Nielsen had put out a top 10 list, it would have been of original streaming shows. So first to streaming originals, it would have been 100% Netflix, with maybe 1 Prime Video every so often, maybe a Hulu show. And then once you had the other streamers, they started to really cut into that lead, especially on the acquired charts, because shows were being streamed everywhere. But what we hadn't seen as much was the originals business really have a lot of different streamers putting a lot of different shows onto the charts week after week. And I think they were actually headed that way. And then we had the strikes. And I think that ended up disrupting a lot of the traditional streamers more, because they had smaller pipelines than did Netflix, who was still the mammoth streamer in the game. So through a lot of 2024, we had periods where, again, the Netflix dominance was all there. But since 2025 has started, multiple streamers have had multiple weekly hits that have done very well, making the charts for multiple time periods. I wrote about this a little bit in my streaming ratings report this week, and next week I'm going to be pulling some of the data. I just need to double check it. But I've been able to chart that even in the originals business, where, again, this doesn't have as much of the complications that the non-exclusive business has, we're seeing that decline. We're seeing it somewhat on the film charts too, especially as theatrical films come back and tend to do well on the streaming charts. So it's something to see going forward, and especially charting that will be interesting to see how that applies to both overall usage and the financial numbers of the other streamers.
So who is catching up the most here? I mean, it's an interesting mix. I get the sense, weirdly, that Paramount Plus is, you know, kind of best positioned out of everybody, but maybe I'm just noticing that more because it's so unusual.
No, it's absolutely Paramount Plus. They started a run, and I feel like I write about this all the time, but then I was like, I don't write about this enough. I don't think it's getting enough headlines. That starting at the end of last year, they had a really clever strategy where they started with Tulsa King second season, and then halfway through, both still on a Sunday, they started releasing previously called Special Ops Lioness into Lioness. Both those are Taylor Sheridan shows. And then halfway through that, they released Mobland. And they built on each other through, or not Mobland, sorry. Halfway through that, they released Landman. And they built on each other all the way through. And then since the new year started, they transitioned that into 1923. And then Mobland, which is finally not a Taylor Sheridan show, but I would say crime show, so Taylor Sheridan-esque. And they've been driving that viewership. The one thing they also do, and this is the difference with Netflix, Netflix will still have more individual shows make the charts, because they'll have a show make the chart on for 1 week, big boot, big jump into its second week usually, then fall off. you know, those with that handful of shows, Paramount Plus has been able to put one show on the service the whole time, and that means keeping those customers engaged. We've actually seen Disney Plus fall off a little bit, but some of the other ones, actually Hulu picked up the slack for Disney a little bit this year. And then Prime Video had a good start to the year as well. But all of them, all those different streamers have been able to get shows onto the charts, including Apple TV Plus also had a good run with Severance Season 2.
And it's interesting, too, because Netflix remains the biggest kid on the block, and they continue to have the most subscribers, and they continue to kind of dominate in terms of pure numbers, except they are now second to YouTube, which I find fascinating and am still not entirely sure what I make of it, because it does seem like the future of media is not original programming. It is not the $2 million, $3 million, $5 million an episode show on Netflix or Paramount. It is the guy in his little office streaming away on YouTube for nothing. Just generating the ad revenue. What do you make of the rise of YouTube as like the real challenger to Netflix's primacy?
Well, first, I think the growth is legitimately extremely impressive. I always want to put that out. I've actually long been bullish on YouTube, and I think it is impressive the growth that they've had. I do think, though, we are in a bit of a news media bubble about YouTube, and that when everyone thinks someone's won the streaming wars, it then becomes everyone has to say they won the streaming wars, and I think the wars are still continuing, so no one's actually won. And I think there's a lot of caveats to put on YouTube's numbers that I put out there because I think it helps provide a more nuanced understanding of what they actually did. So first is their viewership is, and when Nielsen measures this, they measure it through viewership on living room TVs, which is even more impressive because obviously a lot of YouTube viewership is coming on phones and mobile devices, much more than, say, probably anyone, even Netflix or Disney Plus or the traditional streamers. But a few caveats with that. First, music streaming counts into that total. So if someone puts music on in the background, which is a very common use for YouTube, that comes up in their streaming totals. So is it still count as streaming viewership? Are they still delivering ads? Absolutely. Is that what we mean when we talk about watching TV content? Not as much. I would also add the pirated example. There's still a lot. You can find a lot of live streams of sports leagues on YouTube. That's not necessarily legal, but it's not something that when a company has 24 hours to do a takedown notice, that's after the game ends. So that's also not quite legal. And there's a lot of things like that where pirated content still has a use on YouTube. And I just wish the copyright providers were more compensated. But the big thing with YouTube, which you sort of identified, is that the production quality doesn't have to cost as much. But at the same point, YouTube opens up a global market that for most of human history was not really how things were done. And so if you put a successful show on YouTube, you can monetize it globally and YouTube will help you with that. But within individual markets, it means I think the actual returns are smaller. Now, I think some people are actually making now very high quality products. You know, some of the science documentaries, which I watch a fair bit of, they actually have extremely high production quality. But I don't think you're going to be minting, you know, 100 millionaires the way you used to if you, say, had a hit show like Friends back in the day. And that's the big problem. The last caveat I have for Google, which remains super relevant for them, is that, or for YouTube and Google together, is I think a lot more people should talk about how Google helps YouTube succeed versus how YouTube succeeds on its own. It very much matters if you're a search engine that provides 90% of search traffic in, say, most of the developed world, and you're like, hey, which video should I prioritize? This other site that's competing with YouTube or YouTube? There's also, and there are multiple antitrust trials about this, evidence that Google does do steering of ad dollars towards their own operated platforms. If those things disappeared, we'd have a much different competitive landscape when it comes to Google and YouTube.
Do we think there's going to be any real momentum toward breaking up YouTube and Google? Splitting. There are three different things really that could be split up, right? Is Google from YouTube, Google from YouTube or Google from AdSense, which I think would kind of do both of the things that we're talking about here in different ways.
So, as it stands right now, the current proposal for the Google search trial did not mention YouTube at all, but it did recommending divesting the Chrome browser and YouTube not being able to place its search engine. If that hurts Google search, that would obviously weaken its ability to steer to other platforms. In the ad tech trial, I don't think they've actually done proposals yet, but I think there would be proposals to divest some of their ad tech platform. So that actually would hurt if they're benefiting from additional ad inventory sold that way. But then the interesting question would be when you're staying with Google, what does that actually mean at that point? But yes, right now there's been no calls for YouTube to go there. I do sort of bring it up just because I want to like plant the seed in policymakers' heads, though I don't anticipate vigorous antitrust enforcement for the rest of the current administration based off recent decisions they've made.
Yeah, that sounds about right. All right, what else? What else did we want to talk about? You you wanted to praise Across the Movie Aisle for highlighting a great Danny Boyle movie, which I will now allow you to. You can heap praise upon my other podcast. That works. That works for me here.
It's The Beach. I think it is like it's a classic HBO pay cable movie, which if you were alive back then, which, you know, I don't want to date myself, but I was. It was on HBO all the time. Had young Leo, right? Just awesome movie. And so thought that, although my researcher did want to call out that you guys did not draft the movie Trance, and he thought that was an oversight. So I had never heard of it. He was very clear that you did not draft it and that was an oversight.
We did not draft Trance. I would guess I'm probably the only one of us on the show who has actually seen it. And that's a fascinating look. I'll tell you off air what my issue with that movie is. I don't want to spoil it for anyone here. It's an interesting film. I definitely would not put it in my top three Danny Boyle movies though. So I'm okay with missing that one.
Yeah, I just saw it 28 years later, so I'm definitely in a Danny Boyle mindset. So
we gotta work on the Fox Searchlight people to get them to put out a bunch of the old Danny Boyle stuff, because I think that's locked up in the Disney vault somewhere at this point.
Oh,
like,
interesting.
Like, for instance, The Beach, which could really use a nice 4K restoration and release. I feel like people would be up for that. But. All right. What else? There was one last thing I wanted to mention, which is sports, okay. Which is always the kind of like the under discussed nuclear bomb of streaming. The world of sports is fascinating to me because I do have this theory that eventually, in the not too distant future, the sports leagues are going to suffer some pretty massive cutbacks once they run out of people to sell sports games to, because I do think some of these streamers are going to, you know, just get out of sports entirely and others will fold entirely. But I am curious what the state of play on sports in the world of streaming is right now.
Yeah. So over the last year, I feel like there's a bit of a yin yang when it comes to sports media rights deals. So midway through last year, the big news was the NBA signed a huge, massive new deal. The actual gross or the actual increase for that deal wasn't quite as big as the headline suggested, which I wrote about on my website, because partly the deal was longer than the previous deal had been. It also sold more national inventory and involved three people instead of two. Most of those facts got elided to just compare one headline figure with another. But the other big concern, which is still ongoing, is that the regular season ratings for that sport are in decline. And importantly, the local media rights deals are even under even more threat, because as cable bundle shrinks, those regional sports networks are actually going away first. And so an interesting news that literally I just heard about today on the Zach Lowe podcast is that people have been speculating for years that the media rights deal for the NBA is going to lead to this giant increase in salaries for the players. But the NBA caps it at 10% per year. So the projection was for the next, you know, several years, we're going to see 10%, 10%, 10% increase in player salaries, which would imply that, you know, the league's revenue from media is growing even as those regional sports networks shrink. But the league put out, again, according to the Zach Lowe podcast, that next year it's actually going to only grow by 7%, which is, you know, 3% lower than I heard anyone speculate. And so this is because those local media rights are going away. And meanwhile, there's been nothing that has replaced it on streaming only. Now, that's something Amazon would absolutely like to do. It's something, you know, the virtual MVPDs like YouTube Live TV or Hulu Live TV, which is getting spun off, would like to do. But it hasn't happened yet. Actually, 3 years ago, I wrote a worst case scenario for Disney, which I'm actually updating for the Inkler this week. And one of the risks I called out was that sports never actually transitions to streaming. And in the 3 years since, sports kind of hasn't transitioned to streaming, except for a few one-off examples like either Netflix's big events or the NFL on Prime Video, which they also push heavily, but also doesn't do the numbers compared to the broadcasting cable. So after that big NBA ratings headline, though, notably Disney did not sign any new deals with new sports leagues, especially including Major League Baseball, UFC, and F1. And speaking of F1 earlier, you know, if it is such a huge, big, buzzy sport, Disney didn't re-sign on with them because F1 wanted to, I believe, double their media rights deal, and they don't see that. So I think right now a lot of the sports leagues are holding their breath to see where those go. Disney's going to be launching a new ESPN streamer that's going to be very expensive to try and replace the cable bundle. The question is, how many people can they actually get to that? If it's only sports, only fans, is it a much smaller number than when the cable bundle provided all of it? And it leaves a lot of interesting news stories to watch for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I mean, this was kind of my broad point, is that once you strip ESPN out of the protection of the bundle, once you take away the, you know, it goes to 100 million households at $25 a subscriber or whatever number the affiliate fee was, how many people will actually sign up for it? And I've always thought that number was much lower.
Yep.
Than certainly the general subscription number for cable TV. And if it declines enough, that just knocks the legs out of one of the organizations that are bidding up the cost of these things, that just these leagues keep just getting more and more expensive, which seems really untenable outside of the NFL. Right. Always caveat NFL the NFL. That's its own thing.
Right.
But everybody else, I just don't see how you can keep paying this sort of money for the NBA, which is not as popular as its fans on Twitter seem to think it is.
And that's why I think that the NBA overall, their projections for how salaries are going to go, which since it's fixed to the amount of revenue the NBA makes, by definition, that means that the overall revenue pie isn't growing. I think that's one of those signs that there will be a correction as the media rights deals have to match this new reality. The one good news, looking at some of the recent data, is that and I have to like describe this very carefully, the rate in the decline of the cable bundle is stabilized. So what that means is, they went from losing, say, 1-2% of customers in the cable bundle per year, and it went up to, say, 8-12%, according to Moffitt Nathanson's recent report. It's actually starting to slow. So now they're only losing 11-10% new customers per year. So that actually implies that the cable bundle will stabilize somewhere, especially with some of those virtual MVPD options. But even those options are going to be smaller cable bundles than the cable bundle was at its peak, which ties back to what you're talking about. There is going to be less media rights revenue than what the entertainment industry saw at its, say, early 2010s peak. And that's going to be a reality for everyone to get used to.
Yeah. All right. That was everything I wanted to ask. What should folks know about that we did not discuss today? What is in the news that we didn't talk about?
I'll say the thing I have my eye on for July is all the tracking numbers for what I'll call the trio between Jurassic World, Rebirth, Superman, and Fantastic Four. There's no better way to revive the "Hey, superheroes are back" narrative than if Superman and Fantastic Four both do well. Now, from what I've heard on the tracking numbers from a source, both those films have very high awareness, but right now the intent to pay is not great. So a lot of people are like, yes, I've heard of the Superman film, but they haven't said, yes, I'm definitely going to go pay for that in theaters. I will see both in theaters. I would have circled Fantastic Four as the one superhero movie I would see no matter what in 2025, followed by Superman. But I'm curious, that's what the data is, that it has low intent to pay. So I'm very curious how those, if those both do well, we could see a very strong July that could really help revive the theatrical narrative.
Yeah. I'm also curious to see what the numbers look like, because my long running theory is that people just aren't that interested in Superman as a character. I'm skeptical that this will be a huge hit, but I do think people like James Gunn, and it's got that kind of Guardians of the Galaxy vibe to it. So I don't know, maybe it pops. And then Fantastic Four, of course, you know, they've tried two Fantastic Fours. This is the first one that it has a tie to the MCU. So obviously that's going to give it a little boost, but at the same time, you know, that the juice of that franchise does seem to be running out as well. So
I don't know that the Fantastic Four franchise ever had the juice, but the one thing I have seen in the data is that the superhero films based off long established characters do tend to do better than the ones that are based on much newer characters. And these are two of the oldest franchises, though I'll acknowledge those other Fantastic Four films have not done well. But this one also is Pedro Pascal, so he's hot.
Yes.
And if there's any, say, TV shows he abruptly stopped appearing in, you know, maybe those fans want to see him somewhere else.
Well, you know, the numbers don't lie when it comes to The Last of Us. They did not manage to maintain after his exit. So maybe we'll see.
We'll see.
All right. Thank you again for coming back on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here, and always happy to talk streaming ratings and everything else.
And have a happy 4th of July. This is every, you know, 4th of July. Watch Independence Day. It's my favorite 4th of July movie. All right. My name again is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, in addition to being Independence Day fan number one. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. We'll see you again next week.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.